I realized this is not about, I'm a pastor, I'm not involved in politics, I'm just here to preach the gospel. And I realized this is the gospel. I've said to you that as a church and as churches and as pastors, we are to be prophetic. So we should do that. But you notice this, it's prayer and lobbying. Lobbying and being prophetic. And fourthly, living like Daniel in Babylon.
May all that you stand for and that we stand for be preserved under the providence of God for the happiness of mankind.
The trouble is caused by unthinking people who carelessly throw away ageless ideals as if they were old and outworn machinery.
But it is the values of individual liberty, equality before the law, and the supremacy of people over the state to which we can always with confidence return as a powerful and uniting force.
Australia is not a secular country. It is a free country.
Thank you, David, and thank you for the invitation to be a part of this. And I think my involvement with politics is as a prophetic voice, not to be in politics, but to be an agitator to those who are in politics. And so that means that I understand that, as I hopefully I will make clear, that the church is meant to be a prophetic voice. And so that means, in something that Charles Spurgeon said, the church is called to be the prophet in the palace, not the king on the throne. And God appoints those to rule, but he appoints us to be the ones who will uphold his word. I think this journey for me started probably about 25 years ago when I heard a presentation from two British theologians who came under the sponsorship of the Tasmanian Bible Society. And they came and they presented the data on the England of the early 1700s up until 1740. And then from 1740 to 1780, it's known as the, in America it's known as the Great Awakening, but in England it was the Wesley and Whitfield Revival. You know, that was an amazing event, 1740 to 1780, and there were hundreds of thousands of people across England who became Christians. At the end of that 40-year period, and this is the data, and they presented graphs and everything to show this. At the end of the 40-year revival, Wesley's an old man, basically on his deathbed. And the news was, at the beginning of the beginning 1740 through to 1780, there was not one more person in church across England than when they started. Now, if you know how exasperating it is to do a huge evangelistic event and not have any fruit from it, then come and share, we'll both cry on each other's shoulders. Because a couple of years ago, we hosted the Will Graham event. We saw 583 people in Launceston make a decision for Christ. And fortunately, we have got people in our church as a result of that. And we will see lasting fruit. But to see no fruit over 40 years, you can imagine Wesley on his deathbed where he calls for the young 23-year-old politician, William Wilberforce. And there's a famous etching of Wesley from his bed handing Wilberforce a letter saying, "Where I have failed, you must not." And I'm hearing this for the first time. I'm thinking, I've never heard this. This is amazing. And then they presented another graph. And that graph was from 1790 to 1830. And they showed in every denomination, without exception, the graph goes 1740 to 1780, almost flat line. From 1790 to 1830, every denomination goes through the chart, like through the roof. And they said there was no preaching revival. There was no revival. There was no great preaching. But what there was an informed culture. Because what Wilberforce did was, as you may know from a bit of an abbreviated version of his life in Amazing Grace, that movie, where he goes to John Newton and says, I've just been elected to Parliament and I've just come to Christ. I can't be a politician and be a Christian for all the obvious reasons. Why? The obvious reasons were every politician was corrupt. There was talk about vote. These politicians in England in the late 1700s would make Vladimir Putin take notes. I mean, there was literally buying votes to get in. And then when they got in, there was all kinds of graft and corruption. But when Wilberforce went to Newton, the writer of Amazing Grace, that's the title of that movie, he quoted from 1 Corinthians chapter 7, whatsoever state the Lord has found you in, there remain. Now, some of you are going to come up to me and say, oh, that's about marriage. Yeah, it is, but it's also a principle. If God's called you as a whatever, then it doesn't mean just because you've become a Christian, you abandon that and go off and do something maybe you're not called to do. Now we have John Newton telling the young 20-something-year-old Wilberforce, God's called you there. And so from that point, if you know the story, he heeded the words of his pastor. And it was then at a dinner party where what became the beginning of the foundation of what's known as the Clapham sect. Sect sounds like a terrible word, but perhaps we'll use the more contemporaneous word, group. The Clapham group. There's these people, and one of them was a lady who came with a formerly enslaved man from West Africa, who brought with him his manacles and put them on the dining table of Wilberforce. And this lady says to Wilberforce, we understand that you're wondering whether you should remain in politics. Can we tell you there is a great cause that you can uptake for the cause of the gospel of Christ? By doing whatever you can to rid England of its greatest evil in its darkest hour. It's hard for us to imagine just how dark it was. It is so unbelievably dark in the late 1700s. Pedophilia was rampant. Prostitution was rampant. It was not a romantic thing to be involved in the quote-unquote sex industry. It was desperation. And women were treated like trash. They were murdered and found lying on the streets. This was a horrible time. You've got to imagine that now, when we run ahead in the story, because what Wilberforce did was, in Parliament, he would plead with the Parliament and then the nation of England, and everything he said was recorded by journalists word for word and spread around England as he argued for good moral behaviour. How's that for controversial? And everything he said was repeated around England, where he argued the case for what England was doing was immoral and was going to incur, if not the judgment of God, in this age, in the age to come, and we need to repent as a nation. And so with that, people became, for the first time, convicted of sin and pursued the solution. So you had a country vicar in a church in the middle of some county somewhere who wasn't a Billy Graham or a John Wesley or a George Whitefield. He just told them what they wanted to know, what they were looking for. How do I deal with my sin? You read the words of Amazing Grace, who saved a self-esteem deficient person. What? Wretch. Yes, wretch. See the point? That was, yes, we're wretches because of the sin. And this slavery thing is just is emblematic of how far off true north we are. And when I saw that, I realized this is not about, oh, I'm a pastor, I'm not involved in politics, I'm just here to preach the gospel. And I realized this is the gospel. So I want to help you now in my remaining 7 minutes that I've got, David, to explain to you what this means. Because what it means for me is literally, I hope you can hear, it was life-changing. And today I called an impromptu meeting of pastors from around Launceston to come to a meeting with Michelle Pierce, who you'll be hearing from in a bit later. As long as I don't go over my 7 minutes, you'll be hearing from Michelle Pierce a bit later. And I've got to tell you, in a few months, 3 or 4 months, I will have served 29 years here. And I've got to tell you, 27 years ago, for me to talk like this, pastors would just glaze over. And it was so difficult to get pastors to recognize this was actually at the heart of the very thing you claimed you wanted to do, which was preach the gospel so that people came to know Christ. And I've got to tell you, if people don't know what sin is, if they don't understand why the gospel is necessary, then we're going to have a job of a task convincing them they need a saviour.
That's right.
So today, when we put the call out earlier, late last week, Michelle, bang, 30, 40 pastors turn up today. And it was one of the first things I said. 25 years ago, I would have hardly got anyone to turn up. Now they get it.
Yes.
The problem is, between now and back then, 25 years ago, we've had about 40 churches close in Launceston.
Wow.
When we came here, there was 80 Pentecostal churches in Launceston.
Wow.
And now we're dealing with a cultural environment here up in the north where we as churches are working together. There are pastors here tonight from other churches. When we did the Will Graham event, we had 72 churches working together. You were there. We had 350 volunteers, which I think you were one of the two of the volunteers, of the 350 volunteers from churches right across our city. It was great. And you know what? We found 586 people or so came to Christ over that weekend. And what we found out is that Christians from the foundation of this city of Launceston in around 1806, when Launceston was found, they began to pray for this place and they sowed prayer into this place. And the expression that the old Celts use, and in a moment I'm going to be referring to Welsh. Is there any Welsh people here tonight? Oh, well, you'll like what I have to say in a moment. I've been to Wales and I thought they spoke English. I'm sorry, I'm looking at these. How many letters do you need for a town? Anyway, and so what the old Celts described this place as a thin place. It's like a Welsh expression. The Welsh expression meaning that when we pray, God hears. Because the distance between where we are here in Launceston and heaven is so thin. And so when the first horseback evangelist preached on Windmill Hill, got off his horse, got a Bible out, said, you know, gather around, I have something to tell you. That kind of outdoor preaching. Hundreds of people came to Christ in 1824. Now, you've got to put that into the framework of the city of Launceston through the up until about 1850, had a population of 7,000 people. We had that happen, according to Professor Stuart Piggin, who's written the best book on the evangelical history of Australia called The Fountain of Public Prosperity. He describes Launceston, where this has been happening over the past 200 plus years here. This is incredible. And so what happened with Will Graham being here, where a lot of people have said, oh, the days of mass evangelism, they're over with, they're done with, the church is dying, the church is winning, no one will come, no one will give their lives to Christ. Oh, for Pete's sake. So we gathered Christians together, we prayed together, we did what we could because we believe God still saves sinners. J.I. Packer, the great theologian who died not that long ago, wrote a book called Knowing God. And in that book, he describes the gospel in three words. You want to know the gospel, he says? I'll tell you in three words what the gospel is. God saves sinners. And he still does. So let me tell you how this impacts me now. And it impacts me now, and Eric, we, when you were in federal parliament, we were hammering out all sorts of issues around Launceston. I remember being one morning early in what used to be was K&H Cafe there. So I've known Eric for probably 85 years or so, and I thank God for Eric, and I thank God that he got elected into state parliament, because we're at a critical time here. And if you're from Queensland, you must feel like you've walked into God's Garden of Eden, because it's paradise here, really. And spiritually, it's a thin place. It's a thin place. God is doing things, and there's great cooperation in the churches. But okay, we've got one person who understands. Well, has anyone been to Wales and seen the town? Oh my goodness! There we go. So you'll appreciate what I'm about to show you on the screen. Right, I don't know, can anyone pronounce that? Anyway, we'll come back to that in a moment. But here's the point. I want to just mention to you, what are we trying to do? What are we, I'm putting that expression there, what are we engaged in? I want to say, you could answer this question by referring to Ephesians 6. I heard that referred to today, where it says, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. And there's a lot I could say about that, but I've got 6 minutes left, so I'm not going to. But the point is, we're involved in a spiritual war. This is like watching an episode of Seinfeld, isn't it? Where it's like, hang on, 5 minutes ago he said he had 7 minutes. What's this 6 minutes? Anyway, this is how, I don't know, there's a time warp thing up here. You'll see, Dave. Anyway, so.
We also started 10 minutes late.
And we started 10 minutes late, see? So that's how the time warp thing works. Anyway, so now the point being here is, you could say we're involved in spiritual warfare. You'd be absolutely right. There is a spiritual warfare. We have an enemy who wants to do great harm and hinder and, I suggest, distract us. That's probably his main strategy. So here's the question. You could say, well, what are we engaged in? We're engaged in winning the lost. I remember as a teenager reading Proverbs 11:30. I don't know if I said Proverbs 11:30. Does anyone know what that says? He who wins souls is
wise.
Proverbs 11:30. It was through this epiphany of the intersection of politics and Christianity that I looked at that verse again. And I thought, hang on a minute, that's Old Testament. That's not evangelism.
Wow.
It's Old Testament, David. I don't know if you've caught up with the new covenant now and stuff. So we've got in the old covenant, they weren't evangelizing. So when they say win souls, the ESV says he who captures souls is wise. What are we talking about? And here the writer of Proverbs is saying the person who learns how to connect with another human being, where from that connection you've captured their heart, you've won them. You've now got currency with them. You see, here's what I'd really like to say tonight to everyone, but I'm not going to, because I've only got 5 minutes left. And so here's the point. I've heard Christians say some really horrible things to politicians. And if you ask Eric, he'll tell you there are even Christians who've said horrible things and written horrible things. And I'm telling you, that is not how you win souls. It's not how you capture the heart of another human being, especially a politician. There's political decisions that have happened in Tasmania that I do not agree with. In fact, I had great access to the Premier, the previous Premier, Peter Gutwin. And he was very, very kind to me. We had him come and share in our church. We thanked him for his efforts. Because it's a tough gig being premier or a political leader. And I argued with him about euthanasia. I showed him the data about everywhere euthanasia, voluntary assisted dying, is legislated. The suicide rate goes up without exception. Mm-hmm. The data is really, really clear. And since the Tasmanian Parliament voted for voluntary assisted dying, the suicide rate in this electorate of Bass is higher than the road toll. We have one of the highest, about the third or so, highest rate of suicide of anywhere else in the nation. And you got it. And I'm saying, I tried to tell you this. One person in politics who claimed to be a Christian, between them and God, voted for voluntary assisted dying and had allegedly, I don't know if it's true, Christians write to them saying, you will burn in hell now. I'm going to tell you, if that was you, repent, because that's not how you talk to politicians if you want to have any currency with them. And if you're hearing me say, well, we've got to back off the gospel, I hope you're hearing me. I don't back off the gospel, none. But I know he who wins souls is wise. And there's a way to capture heart. So what are we engaged in? So I'm saying, yes, we are engaged in evangelism, the cause of doing that. And you might say, well, let's just jump straight to the Great Commission. Matthew chapter 28, verse 18 to 20. I hope you all know it. All authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, teaching them everything I've commanded. You count the commands of Christ by just simply going through the four Gospels, you'll count about 503 commands that Christ gave for his disciples. So those people who say we're living under grace and not law obviously can't count, because there are laws that Christ expects Christians or people to obey. You see, it's when you realize this is not a club for Christians. This is Jesus commanding all people everywhere from, what's that expression in the Great Commission again? From all nations. Go and baptize all people from all nations. So it's like God, it seems that God expects people to obey him. And I've heard people say, we can't expect non-Christians to obey him because they don't know him. And I'm saying, I think God does expect non-Christians to do both, to know him and to obey him. And this is a part of our job. So what are we engaged in? We're engaged in helping people come to know God. This is the Great Commission. So here's the next question I want to ask. And what can we hope for? What's the best we can hope for? Here's a question. And I did this a few years ago with a pastor's gathering here in Launceston. I said, okay, here's the Great Commission. Are we all in? And they go, yeah, we're all in. This is why we exist. This is what we're doing. Okay, what if we do it? What will that look like? And they're like, generally, the response was, what do you mean? And I thought, that's the problem. We actually don't know what we're trying to strive for. Because I have this thing where if we do our job, not everyone's going to accept the gospel.
That's right.
And I'm not okay with that, but I realize this is reality. So what can we hope for? We can still hope for what, would you believe, last week Richard Dawkins told British TV that, and I quote, he's talking about England, we live in a Christian nation and we have a Christian culture. And he said, Richard Dawkins, if you don't know who Richard Dawkins is, probably one of the world's most famous atheists, said, I am a cultural Christian. I nearly spat my coffee out when I heard him say that. Because for years he's been debating Christians, calling them imbeciles and stupid and all the rest of it for believing Christianity. Now he realizes the very thing he's been calling imbecilic and stupid is the very thing that gave them their moral climate in England of being nice to people, being courteous to people. And it's like Tom Holland, the author of the book Dominion, where he started out writing this book saying, I'm basically going to tell you why I am not a Christian. But here's what I notice about Christianity and how it's shaped the West. And by the end of the book, he's just about repeating the salvation prayer to be saved. And this is Tom Holland, who says of Richard Dawkins, he is being a fool because he's saying, I want to keep the branch, this tree that has as its roots Christianity, but I don't like Christianity, so I want to be on the end of the branch and cut the branch off from the tree. And guess what happens when you do that? You discover Newton's law. And so here we, what can we hope for? I tell you what I hope for. And this is where I'm right open for idealism. I hope that we can see domestic violence decrease because we in our churches begin to teach men how to care for women, how to care for the vulnerable, how to raise children so that they're not terrors, but they're courteous and they're respectful. I actually think that if we took the teachings of Christ out from the church into the world, that we would see the following people better off. Women, men, girls, count them, three, girls, boys, the elderly, and number six, foreigners. I don't know if you see, I did a little maths trick there. There's only five fingers, but I counted the six. It's clever. But you see, all of those categories are better off in any culture that upholds the teachings of Christ. Today, Kim and I spoke with an Iranian family that have migrated here. And he went to great pains to explain to me why they fled Iran. He said, we fled because of the mullahs, that is the teachers of Islam. They oppress us, Persians. It's interesting, he called the Muslims Iranian and he called the people of Iran Persians. So I said to him, you know, one of the people I most greatly admire was a Persian queen. And he goes, oh, really? Who was that? Her name was Esther. Oh, who's she? So for the next 20 minutes, I told him the story of Esther. But he's fled here because he's come to a place where people are respected, people are courteous, and so on. There's my time up. Now, what can we hope for? Prisons having lower populations in them because crime decreases. What can we hope for? Churches filled, not because people are forced to go by legislation, but because they want to go because God has done something in their hearts. And how can we achieve what we hope for? Here's the thing. This is the guts of my message now, and I loved what David said before about the man leaning on a shovel praying for a hole. So here, let me say it far more eloquently than what David could possibly say it. So firstly, how can we achieve what we hope for? Number one, prayer. And I've got to tell you, my understanding through this journey is that we are called to rule and reign with Christ. Now we are seated in heavenly places in a realm whereby our prayer helps Christ's rule to be extended. That's number one, prayer. We should pray more. We should pray very specifically. I just encourage you, pray to God, not against the devil. Pray to God, because if you start yelling at the devil, you're not talking to God anymore. Number two, we should have lobbying. Michelle told me off for not sort of building her up in the eyes of the other church leaders, and I'm sorry about that, Michelle. I thought when I said Martin Niles was okay, but you're great, that I thought I was sort of going partway there, and I meant that. Mark, you were there. You could verify this. So I said, Michelle is great in her role. I love Martin Niles, but I think there was a bit of a mismatch in ACL for lobbying, because he who wins souls is wise. There's a thing now that Michelle's doing very, very well, and you'll be blessed by what she has to say. So lobbying is essential because it helps us to win souls. And then thirdly, I've said to you that as a church and as churches and as pastors, we are to be prophetic. So we should do that. But you notice this, it's prayer and lobbying. Lobbying and being prophetic. And fourthly, living like Daniel in Babylon. I think he won the heart of Darius. He won the heart of Belshazzar. He won the heart of Nebuchadnezzar. And I guarantee you he did not agree with them or their religion one little bit. In fact, we know he didn't. And yet, each of those three rulers over Babylon and then Medo-Persia put him in a position of the highest authority in the land. Even though he disagreed with them and they disagreed with him. And that's awesome. So let me come back to that word I showed you right at the start. And this is my message. And not or. Wasn't really Welsh, I was just tricking. But the point is, we do prayer, we do lobbying, and we are prophetic, and we encourage the believers of our land to live like believers. And by doing that, we are going to go a long way to achieving the kind of relationship the church should have with the state. Thank you, David.
Today, we need a special kind of courage. Not the kind needed in battle, but a kind which makes us stand up for everything that we know is right, everything that is true and honest. We need the kind of courage that can withstand the subtle corruption of the cynics, so that we can show the world that we are not afraid of the future.